still struggling, and with your help, we're going to continue broadcasting FCC or no FCC, preferably the lower, of course. Santa Cruz. This is me. I'm Bathroom Spear Robert Norris. If you've been a follower of the show, you'll know I talk a lot about the police locally, about homeless people's rights, about the rights of poor people generally, somewhat about the U.S. foreign policy regarding Yugoslavia and how that situation over there affects us. I kind of feel that not only is it a homeless issue, since so many homeless people are being created, but in as far as we are conscious activists trying to have a real effect on our community, on the U.S. government, on the effect of foreign policy abroad, we have to take stands on issues that are, well, sometimes unpopular. In Santa Cruz, we didn't get lots of mass protest around the bombing of Yugoslavia, and after the bombing ended, you have heard nary a peep from all the liberal ducklings and progressive wannabes on the city council on this issue. It's all sort of history and under the rubric of the past. But hopefully today we may get a call from some folks who are continuing to have an interest in what's going on in Yugoslavia. Shana Glock-Lazarevic, one of the most eloquent speakers at a number of the Yugoslavia forums, may be giving us a call. We're also going to have an in-studio guest with us today, Anitra Henry, and she's going to be talking about a number of issues ranging from medical marijuana to how, well, what's right with the police, I guess, and that will be one of the subjects she'll be discussing. And I guess Becky Johnson is going to be providing some counterpoint to that. Becky Johnson is a homeless activist. Anitra, I believe, is on the Women's Commission. So we're going to actually let a few women in the studio for once. That's always a relief to those who see this as a white patriarchy, which most of the time it is, of course. Also happening tonight in court downtown, in case you happen to wander on in to the basement court of the county building down at 701 Ocean Street, is the sleeping band case of Dennis Rome. And Dennis is the guy who has been using what's called the Flory Edwards Jacobs defense, the Feige defense, against this sleeping crime that he and so many other homeless people are charged with, the crime of falling asleep after 11 o'clock at night. There's a city code unchanged by the city council, thanks to sleeping band buyers, as we call our mayor, who has kept this code in place, though with lessened penalties. Still too much to pay for any homeless person, so it constitutes, in effect, an anti-homeless law. If you fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night anywhere outdoors, or in a vehicle, you are subject to a $54 fine. If you don't pay that fine, you are subject to a warrant of $100 or $100+. Folks can't pay that. They get arrested. They get jailed. Then they get thrown out in the middle of the night again from jail in a process that is cruel. It's a form of torture, actually, and it's sufficiently bad that it constitutes, in my mind, a banishment order for homeless people. Talked about it at great length on this show. Councilmember Rotkin, who essentially controls this issue in his own way, Byers does as well, but Rotkin and Byers essentially keep this law in place, making it illegal to either sleep after 11 or cover up with blankets, or as it's called in the ordinance, bedding. There are many other options, and of course the continuance of this law makes it difficult for homeless people, like people who are vulnerable particularly, like women and older folks, to call the police when they're assaulted. And there have been numerous hate crimes against homeless people by so-called troll busters. I'm pleased to announce I have no new crimes to report in the last week. That doesn't mean there haven't been any, it's just nobody's called me on them and I haven't heard about them. But there have been over 20 since the beginning of the year by my count, only four of which have made official reports to the police. Because City Council refuses to set up a safe zone, a place where homeless people can sleep without fear of tickets, they really bear responsibility for these beatings. Because if homeless people have to hide from the police, if they can't sleep in safe places or in groups or in well-lit areas, then the people that are preventing them from doing this are responsible for the consequences, and that is our City Council, those great liberals that you elected last fall. At least one of them, Fitzmaurice. Crown and Sugar will not, with any great determination or consistency or persistence, did speak at various points for legal places for homeless people to sleep and basic civil rights for homeless people. Fitzmaurice and Byers have essentially become part of the old guard on this issue. But there are some interesting stories coming up, and of course one of them, as I said, is what's happening tonight in court. Dennis Rome goes to trial. No, actually he's had his sentence. He was found guilty of sleeping in his van. I'm going to read you his statement, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about it, and he may give us a call before the end of the show. This is what he is reading tonight to referee Patterson, who is the judge in Meat Grinder Mulligan's court at this time of night, usually. Could be somebody else. Mulligan usually doesn't come in this time of night, and Patterson's usually the man. He's an attorney, kind of serves as a judge, but he hasn't got quite the authority of a judge, but he in essence does review these cases and can issue fines and sentences and direct the bailiff to arrest you and so forth. And this is Dennis's statement. Well, after five court appearances, the sleeping ticket is now 10 months old, having issued 9/14/98. And no, I have not paid the fine for this ticket. I cannot afford to, and if I could, I would still not pay it based on the fact that this ordinance is a clear and unjust violation of human rights. I could not in good conscience pay a ticket for sleeping, not camping, as it is disguised, for it would be, for me, a violation of my heartfelt principles. Secondly, in what I feel to be purely harassment, this ticket was issued at 8 a.m. with only 1/2 hour remaining in the violation time period of this unjust ordinance. On the morning that my case was initially heard, I was asked how I wanted to pay for this ticket when I was convicted and became a sleep criminal. I said at that time that I did not want to pay it and offered to be locked up, but was told by Mulligan, whatever his name is, that incarceration was not an option because sleeping was an infraction and not a jailable offense. Well, I still do not intend to pay this ticket. Now, regarding the issuance of warrants. At my last court appearance on April 29th, in answer to the first warrant issued, I challenged the validity of the warrant. First, based upon the fact that for violations of ordinances which are infractions, Penal Code Section 1205 precludes imprisonment for non-payment of fines. Secondly, the Attorney General has been very specific about the no-jail rule in Volume 63 of Attorney General's Opinions 418 from 1980, wherein it is concluded that the court does not have the power to enforce a judgment of a fine by imprisonment when at the time it imposes the judgment and authorizes payment of the fine by installments. It does not also provide that in default of payment, the defendant could be imprisoned. At that point, this was not even a possibility with an infraction violation of the municipal ordinance. You agreed with me at that court appearance on April 29th that the warrant was indeed a mistake and should not have been issued. So, once again, the second warrant is invalid. When I answered the second warrant at the warrant section of the third floor of the county building, I asked why another warrant had been issued when I was told by the judge that the first warrant was a mistake and should not have been issued. The clerk checked the computer record and told me that there was no indication that the warrant was a mistake or should not have been issued. I then asked how to clear the situation up without again going to the court, and I was advised to go to the traffic window in the basement and explain the problem. And so I did, and there asked why the warrant had reissued, and I was told that according to the information on the computer record available to them, the warrant should reissue because there was no indication that the first warrant was invalid. I asked to see the computer screen and read each line. Sure enough, there was no indication anywhere in the record that you had told me that the warrant was invalid, indeed a mistake. At this point, I would like to request that you direct the court clerk to enter into the court record that the warrant is invalid under Penal Code 1205 and should not reissue so that this harassment will stop. In other words, what Dennis is asking referee Patterson tonight is that he inform clearly the police authorities and the court authorities by making a written notation, which he should have done last time, that the warrant issued was invalid and therefore could not be issued. He agreed the warrant was invalid because he didn't penalize our man Dennis at all. He said, you can't issue a warrant for non-payment of fines for a sleeping ban crime because the sleeping ban is what's called an infraction, the lowest form of crime. And the only real recourse that the city has is to civilly sue a person for an infraction. That's only true in cases where you're dealing with infractions that don't involve called non-vehicular infractions, of which this is one. And it really is quite an opening for those of us who suffer under the penalties of the sleeping ban if the judge follows the proper letter of the law. Because it means that even though people will be found guilty of sleeping in Santa Cruz and will be fined for it or given the quote option to do community service, which some people term community slavery, they still can decline either of those options and say, I will not do either of this, and if you want to fine me, you can fine me, but you have to, the only recourse you have is you can't jail me if I don't pay the fine. Instead, you have to issue an order that confiscates either my wages or my property, and that's the way to proceed. And we've been trying to get attorneys to successfully use this. We've had actually people do this case in court about 3 or 4 years ago. It's named after three homeless activists, Jacobs, Florey, and Edwards, who each successfully used it at one time or another. And it's not fail-proof, it's not flawless. However, it is something that is a success, that has been a successful avenue in a number of cases, and Dennis is trying it tonight, Dennis Room, and we're going to be seeing what comes of all this. He's going to be calling us in from the court, and solidarity with him. There are a number of people in court tonight. That's in case you want to join them. It starts at 6:30. It's in the basement of the county building at 701 Ocean Street. And it's open to the public. And the question again is, because we can't get the city council to show any backbone or any sense of fairness around the sleeping ban, we have to, in essence, twist our way through the courts to make it difficult, if not impossible, for them to enforce these laws, so they eventually have to set them aside. And that's what Dennis is trying tonight. So that's what's cooking in court around the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. And you can actually read about this issue in Street Spirit. There's actually a new Street Spirit coming out, but in the current issue, if you want to catch it before it leaves the streets, and the Street Spirit is available, by the way, in the library, the downtown library. And it's also available at the Homeless Services Center out at 115 Coral Street at Community House for people to read. There's a whole set of back issues if you want to read about the struggles of the homeless activists here in Santa Cruz and other cities to stand up for basic civil rights and overturn unjust laws, but particularly about this defense, which is called the Florey Edwards Jacobs defense. There's an interesting story from the Atlanta Journal, Constitution. Deal eases city law on homeless by Carlos Campos. Atlanta's effort to crack down on homeless people sleeping and living in parks and other public places has been significantly watered down after a challenge in federal court by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU and the Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless announced Monday the final settlement of a 1997 federal lawsuit they filed on behalf of 9 homeless people seeking to overturn the city's, quote, urban camping ordinance, adopted in 1996. The ordinance prohibited people from sleeping or living in city parks and other public places. It provided for fines of up to $1,000 and jail stays of up to 1 year. The ACLU argued that the law violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution by targeting homeless people. Because homeless people have to sleep, the original ordinance essentially made being a homeless person a crime, said Jerry Weber, legal director for the ACLU of Georgia. Since shelter space allows for only about 20% of the homeless population in Georgia, here in Santa Cruz it's less than 5%, homeless people had no choice but to break the law. The number of homeless in Atlanta has been debated, and estimates range from about 11,000 in a day to a task force calculation that about 40,000 people are homeless at some time during a given year. The metro area has about 2,600 emergency shelter beds. The city council, as part of the settlement, adopted a new urban camping law that allows police to make arrests only if it appears a public park or street is being used, quote, for private living accommodations, unquote. Examples include evidence of regular cooking, erection of structures, and storage of personal property for long periods of time. The city also agreed to pay $28,000 for the nine plaintiffs and $58,000 in attorney's fees. The settlement marks the end of a lawsuit. Last year, the city agreed to provide sensitivity training to police in the handling of homeless people. The initial urban camping law, pushed by former City Council President Marvin Arrington, was adopted as part of a package of so-called quality of life ordinances. The laws, which targeted aggressive panhandling, prostitution, and cruising by motorists, were designed to improve in-town conditions for businesses and an increasing number of new residents. In 1996, Mayor Bill Campbell allowed the urban camping ordinance to become law, but refused to sign it. Clifford Hardick, then city attorney, warned the law probably would be challenged in court. Jabari Samana, Campbell's director of marketing and communications, said the mayor believes in a holistic approach to solving the homeless problem, one that doesn't include arresting the homeless for sleeping on park benches. We feel good that we've been able to resolve the outstanding issue and get the issue behind us, Samana said. This again is a story about Atlanta, Georgia. Deal eases city law on homeless by Carlos Campos from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And the deal here is that they have made, it's kind of like what they did in Santa Barbara and what we asked them to do here in Santa Cruz, but they refused, to make camping illegal, but to make sleeping legal. They actually went a little further. In Santa Barbara, you may remember, in 1986 through 1989, actually through 1990, it was legal for people to sleep, provided they weren't sleeping in places like parks, beaches, or city property that was near City Hall. You could sleep on the sidewalk, you could sleep on other public property that was not in any of those three areas, but you couldn't have anything more with you than you could carry on your back. So you could have a sleeping bag, you could have a blanket, you could have your backpack, but you couldn't, for example, have a tent. You couldn't have cooking apparatuses and so forth. And that's what we've requested, we've proposed as one solution here in Santa Cruz, although again, it's a very miserable solution for folks, particularly in the rain and the cold, but at least it decriminalizes sleeping. It makes it so that at least if you fall asleep, that is not per se a crime. Well, apparently Atlanta, Georgia has gone even further. It said that the only time that it's illegal is if you are using a public park or street for private living accommodations, which involves evidence of regular cooking, so I suppose you could cook once, erection of structures, I don't know if that means a tent, it might, and the storage of personal property for long periods of time. So you can have more than you could normally carry, but you can't keep it there for long periods of time. So Georgia actually has an even more liberal solution than Santa Barbara did, or that we proposed here in Santa Cruz. I don't call it really a solution. It's a solution only in the limited sense that people stop getting tickets for sleeping, per se. But of course, Councilmember Fitzmaurice can't be persuaded to do that, and Councilmember Byers even less so, not to mention the Matthews-Rotkin-Hernandez reactionary right wing. They can't do, can't see their way clear to any kind of basic civil rights for homeless people on the issue of sleeping.
Lady, what do you do all day? Lady, how do you spend your time? Lady,
got no time to be standing here gabbling, got no time to be answering. Beds they making with dishes they washing and venting and dusting and polishing. And scrubbing and sweeping and sewing and cleaning and cooking and ironing. Are you listening? I'm a production line all by myself. Only the wages are missing. Three tips of eight and so seven and two. Measure is just a pathology. When it's over my head, I can't put a foot. It's temporal psychology. Mary's bed wet and Tommy is jealous. The baby is yelling, he's driving me crazy. I'm not such a nanny until I'm a granny. But why is it nobody pays me? Care for a lovely old mother-in-law. She's 87 and cranky. Husband's mother's a feverish cold. One for the tea and the hankies. The hot water bottle, the telly, the paper. And now the kids have it, it must be contagious. So now the family medical staff. But where the hell are we wages? If wives and mothers all take to their heels, you'd soon be needing an army. And paying them all their union wages, I bet it would drive you barmy. All eyes and ears, hands and feet. My sign is Jim and he should have been clear of me. I'm to the work of a dozen a day. But where are the wages due to me? Prices so high, wages so low. Budgeting must be meticulous. The hours I spend in looking for bargain, the cooking is really ridiculous. And though my man's doing all that he can, what he brings home is making us weep. Now I'm prepared for a wage yourself, and the family's going to keep it.
Seeger and Ewan McCall from one of her many fine albums. Ewan's gone, Peggy's still with us, I believe. And more to the point, we have an actual live in-studio guest, as well as an interrogator who's come in with her We have Anita Henry and we have Becky Johnson. Let's see how your mics are doing over there.
I'm right here.
A little louder.
Well, raise the volume then.
There, that's good, that's good. So as I'm going to check this out here, I've actually been given a little background on Anita. She's the commissioner on the Women's Commission of Santa Cruz County, a commissioner on the County Domestic Violence Commission, a welfare rights activist, a medical marijuana user, aha, did you bring anything with you is the question, and a provider. She was diagnosed with hepatitis C virus and has advanced cirrhosis. Her partner is a paraplegic and she is a grandmother, as well as having either the distinction or the disability of being in Santa Cruz County for 13 years. How you doing, Anita?
Very well, Robert. Thank you.
All right. Well, you came with a mountain of literature. I'm not sure, you kind of showed it to me about a few minutes ago. Each piece looks interesting. I'm going to leave it to you where to begin. Should we begin talking about medical marijuana and, I don't know, we could play the kind of the mainstream game. How do you get interested in medical marijuana anyway?
Well, that's an interesting question, Robert. First of all, everybody's interested in medical marijuana. To get involved with my service, though, Robert, you have to be a documented patient. You have to have a doctor that will write you a letter. It doesn't have to be a prescription. It doesn't have to even be a letter that condones the use of your using cannabis, which is what I prefer to call it. That is the medical term for the herb. If you can find the doctor in Santa Cruz County to get yourself a letter to even acknowledge that you use it, and a physician that will agree to continue to provide service to you, I will provide cannabis to medically qualified patients.
How many people actually have been successful in that search for finding a doctor in Santa Cruz County that will give that relatively neutral statement? You're not even asking the doctor to recommend marijuana. Right?
No, the doctor doesn't have to recommend it. They don't have to condone it. They don't have to agree with your use of it. All they have to do is be made aware that you choose to use this herb as medication, to medicate yourself rather than pharmaceuticals. I'll tell you that I have 21 patients. Several of my patients have letters from over the hill or San Mateo County. I have several that drive down to come and see me because it's very difficult for them to be provided for. The majority of my patients have cancer, AIDS, quadriplegics. My youngest patient was 2.5 years old. I had a little girl who had cancer, and her parents allowed me to bake for her, and I would bake her cookies and brownies.
You're the Brownie Mary of Santa Cruz County.
That would be an honor, Robert. Thank you.
Probably an honor well deserved.
I did actually help ease her suffering by baking for her. She unfortunately did die last year.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest client is 92 years old, and she is a woman with glaucoma and has recently had a radical mastectomy. She's a spunky little woman, though.
I guess.
And that's basically how my service works. If somebody has documentation, I can provide them with high-grade cannabis, mold-free, organic. I profit not at all from it. I call myself the kind service. I deliver it. I make in-home deliveries. I have a couple of graduate degrees, and I provide social work, education, and information.
For those of you who want to call in, we're talking to Anita Henry here in studio at 427-3772 on 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Again, the number, if you want to join this conversation, is 427-3772. Now, Santa Cruz had a cannabis club, which closed down, and has an organization called WAM, which does provide, I guess, for a greater number of people, medical marijuana. But again, even they have a huge and long waiting list. Do you find a similar problem? Lots of folks seek cannabis from you that you cannot help them with? Or?
Yes. Actually, Robert, I turn people away every day. Like I said, I only have a handful of patients. Let me give you a little bit of background about my own use of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm a counterculture person. I grew up smoking marijuana. I'm 50 years old. I grew up in New York. I've used it to help me with my anxiety, with my stomach problems, even before I was diagnosed with my illness. I always found it to be a healing herb. It's never held me back. I got several degrees at the university. I'm a very clear, sharp thinker. I was a member of the club in Santa Cruz. It was the Santa Cruz County Cannabis Buyers Club.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they had a very poor reputation. I had some problems with them, as did many other people, and they eventually self-closed. They actually let me get their medical records. I got their medical records and their financial records, and they actually closed their door. Had I wanted to, I could have pursued over 500 patients, but chose not to.
Hi, you're on the line with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Sure, my name's Nina Blackmore, and I wanted to call in support of Anita Henry and everything that she has to say. I think she's been more than compassionate to the Santa Cruz members that were turned away when the Santa Cruz Club did close. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to her on the radio tonight and thank your station for letting her speak her mind, because she's a wonderful woman, and she does provide compassionate and sensitive service
now, wait a minute,
to those who
are
in need.
Are you a paid caller? How much is she paid?
Yeah, absolutely not.
All right. Anything you want to add about this? Or?
Well, I am disappointed that the club did close and that there are, you know, not a lot of avenues for people, and that it is hard for the doctors. You know, they feel like they're kind of in a strange position and don't want to, you know, advocate a lot of times for people who are in need, and that makes it tough for people like Anita. But I've seen her go through a lot for her patients, and she deserves a big thank you.
Wow, Nina, thank you so much
for
calling.
You're welcome, sweetheart.
You know, and it actually takes us to a good point. You know, Prop 215 passed, and the vote is overwhelmingly supported the use of cannabis for people who were ill. It's also been supported in several other states recently, but for some reason the feds just will not get off this. They just...
Maybe Bill's upset because medical marijuana got more votes in California than Bill Clinton did.
Well, you know, it's a possibility, and it's a bigger issue than I can even address. What concerns me most is the fear that doctors are living under, because I have people, for example, my 92-year-old patient, glaucoma, radical mastectomy, she's 92, God's sake, her doctor will not give her a letter. She has no letter.
Trying to go to another doctor.
She can't find a doctor to give her a letter. And now remember, she's 92 years old. She's not going to jump in her car and go looking around for doctors. The woman is ill.
Mm-hmm.
I provide a service to her.
So has anything bad happened to doctors that have provided letters that you know of, Anita?
I don't think anything bad has happened to doctors who have provided letters, but doctors are under the fear of having their licenses taken away. There was a doctor in Santa Cruz. I'm not going to mention any names. There's not necessarily any reason to. But we did have a doctor in Santa Cruz who was especially understanding and compassionate, and had written many letters for people only if they had qualified illnesses that would allow them to use cannabis to relieve their pain. When, I believe it was Pete Wilson, I don't remember exactly who it was or when it came down, the threat was made to doctors, if you prescribe, if you recommend, you will lose your license. So this doctor, unfortunately, will not write. If you go in there and you're a quadriplegic, or you go in there and you have cancer, mm-hmm. he will tell you, I would love to write for you. I believe in
you. Even though there's a change of governors.
Well, even though there's... did you hear what just recently happened? You know, they're working on the statewide registry system. I don't know if you're familiar with
tell
this, Robert.
Tell us about it.
There's actually a group of people up north. I belong to the California Coalition of Cannabis Providers, and we meet usually every month. And there are lawyers, doctors, health professionals, all kinds of people, professional, intelligent, reasonable people, working on this, it's called a statewide registry system. And I read a little article in the paper the other day saying that this was going to go before the state legislature. And then I heard on the radio this afternoon that Gray Davis said there's no way this will never even make it close to the legislature as long as it goes against federal law. So we're back again in a vicious cycle. It's states' rights, feds' rights.
That's Governor Gray Davis.
That's Governor Gray Davis, excuse
Governor
me.
Governor
yeah.
Chicken Shit Gray
yeah.
Davis.
Chicken Shit, who was
yeah.
so kind and loving and compassionate before he was elected. Now he's elected, and he says this doesn't even have a chance to get through the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very troubling to me, because what we really need to do, Robert, is take this issue away from law enforcement. This is not a law enforcement issue. They are locking people up. They are breaking families up. They are wasting our money and overcrowding the jails with people who are trying to medicate themselves. We live in a very complex, stressful world. I never encourage people to go out and have a shot of vodka, buy a bottle of gin. They'll go home and beat their wife. But I do recommend to people, if they're suffering, if they're in pain, if pharmaceuticals make them sick, if they're too harsh on their system, try smoking cannabis. If you don't want to smoke, because smoking is unhealthy, anytime you burn, you're creating carbon monoxide, we know that, you can eat it. You can take it in a tincture form. You can cook with it. You can bake with it. But it does provide relief.
It's also, I guess, you can also vaporize it if you...
Yeah, that's the new thing they're working on now. There's a vaporizer that's out. And I also think the feds are working on an inhaler. I believe, actually, you mentioned Wham and Valerie Corral. I believe she is working in partnership with somebody.
Now, Wham is...
Wham is the women... I believe it's Women and Men's Medical Alliance for Medical Marijuana. Yeah, I had applied to become a member of Wham when I had so much unhappiness at the Maple Street Club, but I wasn't accepted as a member, and that was actually the impetus for me starting MedX.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually had this service going almost 3 years. I started it because I saw the need. I saw people getting ripped off. I saw people smoking things that were unhealthy for them to smoke. I didn't have access. And
I saw people getting busted on the streets by local police officers
right,
who have better things to do.
That's true. The police are kept very busy here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Robert, I don't know if I mentioned it on the air, but I am police friendly. I am law enforcement friendly. I've worked with law enforcement. I've worked with the sheriff.
That's right. I have to put you under citizen's arrest.
That would be okay. I don't always have to be politically correct. I've been there. I have my own opinions on this. I don't think...
Actually, in Santa Cruz, it's politically correct to praise the police. It's only the sort of the radical fringe that is regarded as where it's considered to be appropriate to be critical of the police.
I think it's a good thing to be critical of the police.
I do, too.
It's a very good thing, and I think that the police do need to be watched and supervised. I totally agree with
that. That's
you.
The subject I want to talk to you about, but let's continue first, though, with your really knowledgeable discussion of your work with MedX, and also, I mean, are there other organizations locally that try to do what you do? We've talked about the Closed Cannabis Club. We talked about WAM, which you said has a long waiting list, has a number of difficulties. Apparently, you had some.
Right, I've had several people call me and tell me they were on WAM's waiting list. Could I take them?
Right.
But I'm very discriminating about who I take because I provide in-home support service to people. So it's not like I'm coming and dropping you off a bag. It doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
People have to be documented. They have to be ill.
Mm-hmm.
I will come and bring it to their house. I will spend time with them. I will talk to them. I will advise them. I will educate them on how to keep their smoking implements clean or on how to make bud butter or whatever they need
to do.
Or
to the police breaking their door and that sort of thing.
If they're documented, the police are not going to break in their door. There is a law enforcement protocol in place in Santa Cruz, and I can bear witness to that because myself...
What is the strange story I read in the paper about this woman who had a home invasion? Didn't she have a problem with the police?
No, actually, the police were my friends. My enemy is your common man on the street.
Right, you are. That wasn't...
No, the police actually, helped me. I was home invaded.
Right.
I did get home invaded because bad people were trying...
Right?
They wanted my men. They kicked in the doors and bound and gagged my son and daughter, and under the threat with loaded guns, demanded the keys and the address to my apartment. And I have a daughter who was very afraid, and she gave the keys to my apartment, was fortunate enough to get out, get her brother and her baby out, get in touch with the police. The police surrounded my housing complex, and they actually did catch one of the fellas. I was happy with the police. My unhappiness lied with the district attorney when they let the creep out on bail.
So he is out now.
He jumped bail. So all three men that kicked in my doors, bound and gagged my children, shot at the police, busted through my neighbor's door, are loose on the street. And I feel like I'm a target when I drive around town.
How long ago did this happen?
This happened September 28th at 10:30 at night.
So have you had any further interactions with any of these people since then, or have they pretty much stayed away?
Hopefully they're staying away. I mean, there are warrants out for their arrest, so I don't think they're coming, around anytime close or anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my fear. I don't fear local law enforcement. I feel as long as I'm following the law, which I believe is Prop 215, whether we call that law or not, the people have spoken. It's a healing herb.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I'm doing something good, and I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing.
We're talking to Anita Henry, who is not only active in the Women's Commission and as a welfare rights activist, she's also active fighting her own illnesses. And I guess I'm going to, you can talk about what you want here, but I'm going to kind of continue to draw you back toward issues that I think, well, I'm sure issues of illness resonate for all of us, too. I'm wondering if I'm going to get hit. We got an incoming call here. Is this another one of your paid calls?
I have not paid anybody to call us.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, my name is Steve.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, how does one get connected with Anita for her services?
Anita?
Well, patients who are interested or who have documentation from a letter, get a letter from your doctor. First of all, you have to have an illness. You go to your doctor, you tell your doctor that you use cannabis, it provides you with relief. Ask for a short, brief statement from your doctor acknowledging the fact that you do use cannabis. It does provide you with relief. Your doctor doesn't have to agree with this, only acknowledge it. Call my service at 425-3444. Listen to the message, and I will get back to you and come out to your apartment and do an intake.
Give that number again.
That's 425-3444.
Got that, Steve?
I got it. Okay. Well, I think she's fantastic, and I'll see what I can do.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's so nice. I'm glad people are listening and calling in.
Yeah. I have a question. Yeah, by the way, the call number, the call number is 427-3772, and you have a question.
Yeah. Proposition 215, being an initiative, is considered a statement directly from the voters. And where anything that's produced by the legislator is kind of one step removed from democracy, in the sense that the voters elected a representative, and then the representative passed legislation that terms our body of laws. Doesn't Prop 215, isn't that considered to where it conflicts with legislative law, that 215 should prevail?
Actually, what 215 did is, Prop 215 did not legalize marijuana. It just changed how certain people, particularly doctors, medical patients, and their primary caregivers, would be treated by the court systems. With a doctor's recommendation to use marijuana, they now have a legal defense. It's called the doctrine of necessity. When I come out and do an intake with people, I bring them several pages. One is a text of Prop 215, so they have a better understanding of what it is the voters passed. Another is I give them a copy of the doctrine of necessity, and I'm going to leave all of this with you tonight, Robert. I brought all of this for you. I also, when I do my intake, I go through a brief history of medical marijuana, talking about the first recorded use of marijuana, marijuana's references in the Bible as an herb. And then I also hand out a sheet for people to become more politically active themselves, because the world does not change, you know, one person. Everybody has to do something, and I strongly encourage all of my patients to become politically active, to make phone calls, to fax, to write, and just to bombard our legislatures, because that's what the personal is political means.
You know, I wonder if there isn't a good option here for individuals to pressure doctors in Santa Cruz. I think everyone listening to this broadcast should contact their doctor and write them a letter asking if they allow patients who come to them facilitate their use of marijuana if they are, you know, if they don't have to recommend it, but would agree to. Again, you need to require what specifically from a doctor? A statement that, run that by me again. What's required?
See, listen, Prop 215 did this. Mm-hmm. As a new law, it protected three classes of individuals. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading this from a brochure that is titled Medical Marijuana Guidelines for Physicians, an overview of Prop 215, the federal response, and physicians' rights. This is written by Bill Panzer, who is a lawyer and a member of the legal team that I work with up in Oakland. These are the three classes of people that have been affected. Seriously ill patients may possess and cultivate marijuana for personal medicinal use with a physician's recommendation or approval. Mm-hmm. Primary caregivers may possess and cultivate marijuana for the personal medicinal use of a patient. And now a primary caregiver is defined in the law as the individual designated by that person. who has consistently assumed responsibility for that person. So you can't have 10 caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be somebody who's looking out for your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And the third class of individual being protected under Prop 215 is physicians. And this says that physicians are protected from any state, criminal, or civil liability for recommending or approving the medicinal use of cannabis by a patient. This was fine when Prop 215 passed. I believe it was in 6 to 8 months that Pete Wilson said, it was actually Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
It was our president who didn't inhale, who said, doctors will lose their license.
Well, have any doctors actually lost their license?
No.
Okay, so this is a threat. It seems to me that the doctors, those high-paying, mostly big boys, I guess we've got some women who are physicians as well now.
Come on, don't be sexist now, Robert. We have plenty of the women who are doctors.
There are more of them in Russia, I can tell you that. But yes, certainly, men and women, physicians. I would like to see some courage on the part of these physicians, and I would like to see patients demanding courage, not just on the basis of marijuana for themselves. I think everyone out there should write a letter to their doctor or telephone their doctor and like to know, have you ever issued a letter which stated that you were aware that a patient was using marijuana and found that it had been helpful for them? At least that was what they said. Isn't that what you need in a letter from a physician?
You do. You know, when I first went
to
my...
You don't need to say it's okay.
Right. No, you don't. I
am aware that my patient is using marijuana and that she or he feels it's good for him.
Right. My patient is using it. They have informed me of their use, and I will continue to be this patient's primary care physician.
So that's all they have to say. You don't have to put your, you know, come out and do the Bill Buckley thing, which National Review does. The right-wingers do it. They say marijuana is, you know, the war against drugs is the ultimate stupidity, particularly against marijuana. You don't have to take an ideological position. But what you have to do is you have to take a position of care for the people that you're making your living off of. These physicians are making their living off of the community.
Well, it's the pharmaceutical companies, actually. I think that's where the problem lies.
But the doctors are as well. Now, the doctor doesn't have the courage to say, here's a letter that says, I know you're using marijuana, I'm your primary caregiver, and I understand you told me that. If they can't do that in Santa Cruz County, I don't think they deserve to have a license to practice medicine.
Let's not get too extreme. Let me tell you what happened with me, Robert. I went to my doctor.
Good luck in that.
I went to my doctor and I asked for a letter when Prop 215 passed, and she told me no.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'm not leaving here without a letter.
Right.
I've heard there's a club up in San Francisco. I want to go up to this club. Write me a letter. She told me no.
Mm-hmm.
I had to argue with her. I had to cry. I had to plead on my 30-year history of feminism.
Well, that's a bunch of horseshit. Why did you have to do that?
Well, this is what I'm recommending to people. Not that they go and they cry to their doctor.
No.
Go into your doctor with ammunition. Go and do some research. Go and get some background information. Find, if you're on pharmaceutical drugs right now for an illness, find out if they're harsh on your system. Find out how hard they are on your liver. Find out how toxic they are. Get some information. Go to your doctor. Most doctors, let's assume. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
I don't give them the benefit of the doubt. I think that's a bunch of crap.
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
You give them the benefit of the doubt. I want to say this. I would like to see, it seems to me that we need a group of people who patients can go to and complain about doctors, who then issue letters of complaint to the medical boards that are appropriate, who write letters to the newspaper denouncing these physicians, so that the doctors, unless they have a damn good reason, and I can certainly concede that doctors may feel this may be abused. And
they're just afraid of losing their license.
Well,
that's a very real threat.
That's not a very real threat if it's never been done.
It's never done until it's done.
Right. Well, then these doctors have got to say they've been making I don't know how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands a year. That they have to take that risk because the health of the community, the health of the patients, the pain that these people who are near death or suffering is at stake.
I agree. In my case, my doctor explained to me that smoking is not healthy. Smoking is poison. I agree with her. Smoking anything is not healthy. It's my choice.
That's the obvious thing. We shouldn't have to go to a doctor to get this kind of information. The fact that they're being put in this position means, you know, it's unfortunate to a certain extent that they are. I don't think they should be in this position, but given that they are, they need to take the responsibility and carry through that. If they don't, they need to have their asses kicked.
Well, I think that Patients need to advocate for themselves. Patients need to empower themselves. I did it.
Yes.
I did it.
You did it. It's easy to say, however, when you're sick and when you're feeling bad, you know how difficult that was even for you to do that, and what a grueling process it was for you.
You know what? I walked out with my letter, though.
I'm glad. And then as you walk out with your letter, but you apparently walked out empowered to seek letters and to advise other people as to how to get these things. But yours is not a typical case, I don't think. What we need to do is establish a process by which everybody in this county who wants access to medical marijuana can get it. And doctors who block that process are publicly named and exposed one after another. And if this begins to happen, they will stop doing it. That's
you're frightening.
I want these fuckers to start giving people back their rights. I'm real tired of people having to suffer. We're not just talking about people who are, you know, out for a, you know, a quick high. We're talking about people who need this stuff.
Right. That's where we need to differentiate.
Yeah.
This is not about the legalization of marijuana. This is actually about getting an herb to people who believe it helps them. If you have glaucoma, it releases the pressure in your eyes. If you're quadriplegic or paraplegic, it reduces your spasms. In my case, I have advanced cirrhosis. I have terrible cramps and pains in the morning. I'm nauseous in the morning. I just feel miserable. I have to wake up and burn a few bowls. It's just that easy. And I can go about my day. I'm an especially productive person. So I don't buy into the myth. That's another thing we have to do, is start dispelling all these myths.
How many doctors do we have in this county? Do you know?
No.
Well, I think, you know, I would like to, people are interested in forming a group and get together to just start calling up one doctor after another and asking for a simple statement that if one of your patients comes to you and asks for a letter that states, I'm aware that my patient uses marijuana. I understand.
I think we should call it cannabis, too. I think because cannabis is really the medical term.
Yes, sure.
Marijuana is a street name.
It states those essentially neutral kinds of statements that one would think you pay for when you pay the fucking fancy prices
hemp?
Well,
hemp is also rope.
It's part of the plant, but it's not the part of the plant that contains the medicine.
Anyway,
THC.
I want to see these doctors accountable, and I think the way to do it is to have an activist organization that goes to the doctors, that isn't even associated with the doctors, that says, look, we're not your, you know, patients. We couldn't care less. We want to make sure you're not blockading your patients. Unless we start learning that you aren't doing this, we'll seek some legal means of pressuring you, or we'll start pressuring you through the media. I mean, I think it is a form of torture.
But I agree with you, Robert, but let's have a little bit of balance, because as we mentioned at the top of the show, there is an organization named WAM. They have a very long waiting list of patients, so apparently there are doctors that are writing the letters. The problem comes in the void, how to provide to the people that need the medicine. Not everybody can grow their own. How are they going to get the herb once their doctor gives them a letter? How do they get it?
I would say some community marijuana fields would be appropriate.
Some co-op.
And
we need to have a nice piece
nice
of property somewhere.
Fields. Of course, we need to protect it to stop those home invasions, since marijuana, thank you, federal government, is now more costly than gold. The whole thing, of course, gets me into a tizzy, as it should. It should get anyone into a tizzy. The insanity involved in the massive corruption involved in the drug war. The real thing that pisses me off is that local politicians don't do shit about this. And the police department, your friends, the police department, continue to harass poor people around issues of medical marijuana, or even as ordinary marijuana.
But that's not endemic to Santa Cruz County. I mean, you're going to find that nationwide.
I live in Santa Cruz County, and where I see it, it may not be endemic. You might say, hey, everywhere in the South, they kick those blacks around. But if you live in a city, your responsibility is the people in that city, and you have to comment on what goes on there.
I would tell you again, though, I believe that we live in one of the most humane counties.
What would Becky Johnson say about that?
Let's hear what Becky Johnson has to say.
I don't know how humane. I've been down at the courthouse and seen all kinds of people just lining up day after day and getting charged with marijuana possession, possession of paraphernalia, possession of marijuana to sell. They're getting big fines and big sentences and criminal records. It's a big industry. I've also heard that a lot of the pot, when people are busted, that when they go to weigh it in, it's not all there. Sort of, you know, the actual police who are busting them or siphoning off their pot, especially if it's the good stuff.
I don't know that to be true, so I really can't comment on that. I don't know that the police do that.
Well, we at Huff, we hear lots of reports from people who are unlikely to file complaints in many cases. They'll tell us about it, but they're not going to go through official channels on that. And you know, maybe it's a service, you know, they're charged with less weight when they're fined. I mean, you can't, you know, it's a double-edged sword in that way. One of the things that I would like to see happening right here in Santa Cruz County is for us to use jury nullification to fight this drug war. And that is, that would mean that people, when they're arrested for possession of a substance, that they should plead not guilty, demand a jury trial, and then anyone in the county who has the opportunity to be a juror, that they, instead of doing what almost everybody does, is to try to get off of being on a jury, that they actually try to get on the jury. And that's no small trick, because the potential jurors go through quite a series of questions, and anyone who really knows anything is weeded out. Little pun there. But jury nullification allows for a juror to vote their conscience, or vote, and when they get to deciding on a case, they could not just listen just to the law that is being told to them by the judge or the attorneys or the district attorney, but they also can tap into their general understanding of the law or their understanding of constitutional law. For instance, the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution prohibits excessive fines. I mean, possession of such a helpful and healing herb as marijuana, any fine would be excessive. And that it would be reasonable for a juror to, even if the person was found, you know, there was no argument about the facts of the case that person was in possession of that substance, it's just not reasonable to find them guilty.
You see, the thing is, we have to change the law, Becky. That's what the problem is. We have to change the law, because as long as marijuana is illegal, law enforcement is going to do their job.
You know, it's actually true. This method of jury nullification, which Becky suggests, and has been proposed by the Fully Informed Jury Association, FIJA, they've been putting it around for the last decade, is one approach that may be effective in changing the law. Because a lot of past precedents kind of speak out from history. For instance, fugitive slave law was made a dead letter by the fact that juries would refuse to convict. Fugitive slave law ruled that if you were a slave, was made it up to the North in the time before the Civil War, that it required people to give the slaves back, and and also to convict the people, or to convict the slave of being a fugitive and then sending that slave back, juries wouldn't convict. Similarly, juries wouldn't convict under prohibition, under alcohol prohibition during the 20s. For possession of alcohol or possession with intent to use, because they thought it was ridiculous. And during the Vietnam War, you had a similar situation where people would not be convicted. So I think what the basic rule here is that a judge may tell you, you know, you may disagree with this law, but you have a sacred trust to simply decide whether the person had the marijuana in her or his house, and not whether it's a good law or a bad law. You should not, when the judge says that. That's fine. Whatever he says, yeah, sure, thank you very much. But the fact is, the jury is the final arbiter of what happens. That is really the fourth branch of government. You have these fancy hierarchies, bureaucracies, and superstructures which none of us have any real input into in any real way. The judiciary, the legislature, and the executive branches, which, you know, they're essentially run by money and big interests. But the juries, you do have some interest in, because one juror stops a guilty verdict. It's true that you need 12 jurors for a non-guilty verdict, but one juror can hang a jury and require a new trial. And if that happened persistently enough in our courts in Santa Cruz County, they would stop trying marijuana cases. So I think we need to set up a little table right outside the courthouse with information about fully informed jury stuff, and also specifically targeting these drug war prosecutions. Demand that our district attorney stop prosecuting marijuana cases. Period. Just stop it right now. No further prosecutions. Thank you very much.
Let me give you some of these statistics I have here. I have the latest government statistics for 1998. More than 70 million Americans have smoked marijuana at some point in their life. 18 to 20 million smoked during the last year, and 10 to 12 million smoked during the last month. Marijuana is the third most popular recreational drug of choice for Americans, exceeded only by alcohol and tobacco in popularity. Like most Americans, the vast majority of these millions of marijuana smokers are good citizens. They work hard, they raise families, they contribute to their communities, and other than marijuana smoking, they're indistinguishable from their non-smoking peers. They're not part of the crime problem, and they shouldn't be treated like criminals. In 1998, the most recent year for which, you know, this was just last year, the FBI statistics are as follows. Police arrested 695,000 Americans on marijuana charges. 87% of those arrests were for simple possession, not sale. This is the most marijuana arrests ever recorded in this country, with one American being arrested on a marijuana charge every 39 seconds. Every 39 seconds, somebody is being arrested for smoking marijuana.
So what does this tell us,
Anita? That arresting and jailing otherwise law-abiding citizens who smoke marijuana is a wasteful and incredibly destructive policy?
No, we knew that 20 years ago.
That it wastes valuable law enforcement resources, which should be focused on violent and serious crime?
We knew that 15 years ago.
That it invites government into areas of our private lives that are totally inappropriate?
We knew that 10 years ago.
That it frequently destroys the lives, careers, and families of genuinely good citizens, and it's just about time to end marijuana prohibition, Robert.
Yeah, we know that. The problem is, that can be said 100 times, and we knew it 3 decades ago.
But we've come a long way. It's slow. It's slow.
Yeah, we've come a long way. You just read the statistics that show it's worse than ever.
More arrests than
ago.
Ever.
We've come a long way in the wrong direction.
Yeah. More
that's
arrests
a problem.
Than ever. That's because of the war on crime.
Well,
is a farce.
The war on drugs.
Like the war. Oh, the war on crime.
Right.
Drugs.
The drugs
war on poverty.
Crime.
There are crimes.
The war on people. But the problem is, you know, you make these perfectly reasonable arguments, which were just as true.